Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, February 16th. I'm Kevin Rogers. We welcome you to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. We're having a beautiful day in Fort Dodge. It's still cold, still plenty cold, but it was 10 degrees above zero last time I checked. And that feels a whole lot better than what we've experienced. We'll take a look at a more complete long-range forecast towards the end of our time together. We have breaking news on the Messenger website today from Eagle Grove. On February 16, 2021, at 5:42 a.m., the Wright County Sheriff's Office received a report of a stabbing at Prestige Foods located on Highway 17, south of Eagle Grove. Deputies responded and located a deceased individual inside the employee locker room area within the plant. Deputies identified a suspect who is in custody. The initial investigation revealed the victim and suspect knew each other. The Iowa Division of Investigation is assisting the Wright County Sheriff's Office. The release of names is pending family notification. Deep freeze is the title of the next article. With bitterly cold temperatures across much of the United States this past weekend and extending into today, the nation's energy providers are feeling the impact of consumers using more heat at home. On Monday, Mid-American Energy Company sent out a release asking customers to reduce their natural gas use for the next few days due to the extreme weather. The extreme weather that's impacting the rest of the country is putting a strain around the supply of natural gas, but our systems are operating as expected, said Tina Hoffman, a spokesman for Mid-American. To manage the supply of natural gas, Mid-American is coordinating with its largest customers to ensure uninterrupted gas service for residential customers. As temperatures rise over the next few days, the issue is expected to resolve itself. In large parts of the South, rolling blackouts have been a feature of the coldest snowy weather to which the region is unaccustomed. However, Hoffman said, Mid-American electric customers won't have to worry about losing power because of the Arctic temperatures. Our systems have been operating really well under the cold conditions, but we are not anticipating that. Mid-American operates on a different regional grid system than the areas that are experiencing the surge in electricity use and power outages. Though Mid-American customers won't see any disruption in their services, other residents in Northwest Iowa regions may still experience some brief power outages. Due to an unprecedented electric load, Corn Belt Power has been asked by the Southwest Power Pool, its regional transmission operator, to shed load in its service territory. Members may experience intermittent power outages lasting 45 minutes. Corn Belt Power Cooperative based in Humboldt published on its Facebook page on Monday. The Southwest Power Pool covers much of Northwest Iowa. Midland Power Cooperative, another local electricity provider based in Humboldt and Jefferson, sent out a similar post warning customers of the possibility of power outages. Both cooperatives are members of the Iowa Association of Elective Cooperatives. If a power outage does occur, the IAEC encourages customers to find a room in the warmest part of the house, away from winds and exterior walls, to wait out the outage. Other tips include keeping curtains and exterior doors closed, wear layers of loose-fitting clothing, open all faucets slightly so they drip, and prevent pipes from freezing. Close off as many rooms as possible. Do not use the stove, oven, cooktop, outdoor grill, or camping stove to try to produce usable heat inside the home. Use a fireplace if you have one. Wind chill values as low as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit are expected today. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, a COVID vaccine clinic is being set for Friday. Appointments are required with 500 slots available. Webster County Health Department will offer a COVID-19 vaccine clinic on Friday for Webster County residents age 65 and older who are not actively sick or in public health isolation. The clinic will begin at 12:30 p.m. at the Crossroads Mall. All vaccinations will be by appointment only. The health department reported that 500 appointment slots will be open at 1 o'clock Wednesday. Appointments can be made online at webstercountyia.gov. The appointment link will be located in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. If the link does not appear immediately, refresh your screen. Appointments can be made also by calling 515-227-7104. The phone line and website link will only be active beginning 1 o'clock p.m. Wednesday and will close as soon as all appointment slots are filled. Residents will be asked to provide their name, address, date of birth, and phone number. Insurance information will be collected at the clinic. Only those with appointments will be allowed into the clinic. Please arrive no more than 10 minutes before your scheduled time. There will be a 15-minute wait after the vaccine is administered, dressed in layers, so that one arm is accessible. Park in the lot in front of the mall's west entrance. Masks are required. Those without insurance will not be turned away. The health department reported that it is working on the logistics of getting vaccines to homebound individuals and those unable to get to the mall. Day 5, the signs in hindsight, is the defense moves for a mistrial in the Bassett murder trial being held in Webster City. That is our next article. On the fifth day of Zachary Bassett's first-degree murder trial, several witnesses testified to the instances of domestic abuse they witnessed with victim Andrea Sokolowski throughout their relationship and in the days leading up to her death. Accounts from acquaintances describing the times they tried to shield Sokolowski from Bassett at a bar, and the couple's landlord describing broken property at their Second Street apartment in Webster City, were quickly dwarfed by death threats, overt instances of physical assault, and observation so strong that the defense once motioned for a mistrial. Bassett faces the charge after Sokolowski was reported as unresponsive in their apartment. She was pronounced dead at age 50 at Van Deese Medical Center in Webster City after paramedics and medical personnel exhausted resuscitation efforts. Even before the couple moved to Webster City with Bassett's job as a traveling welder, Sokolowski, best friend for 17 years, described the relationship as, quote, volatile at best. There was a plastic bag with Gatorade bottles, said Jennifer Ernst of Ida Grove. He had swung around and hit her on the head. She had a huge knot and bruise on her head. Ernst said the damage didn't stop with the assaults either, testifying that Sokolowski's tires had been slashed on several occasions and that she went through multiple cell phones as each one was broken. At one point, she and Bassett left a voicemail threatening, at one point, she said Bassett left a voicemail threatening to kill both her and her friend. The accounts ran parallel to what Ernst's then-husband John Ernst saw. Sokolowski had her back turned. He went behind her and threw her on the ground, he said, of one altercation. In a later conversation near Sokolowski's hometown of Sioux City, John Ernst recounted a chilling conversation with the victim in which she was trying to find new living arrangements. Why did Sokolowski tell you she couldn't go back to living with Bassett? Asked Assistant Attorney General Nicole Leonard. She told me he'd kill her, John Ernst said of the conversation, 3 weeks before the victim died. The defense disputed Jennifer Ernst's claims on cross-examination as vendettas in her self-proclaimed hatred of Bassett and highlighted potential credibility issues, citing a prior theft conviction. Defense attorneys also attempted to impeach the victim, asking witnesses to weigh in on questions insinuating that she was known to exaggerate, which witnesses resisted on the stand. At TK's bar in Webster City, even new acquaintances stepped in to protect Sokolowski from a man they perceived as abusive when Bassett repeatedly attempted to pull her home by the arm. Bartender Reno Ewing, meeting the victim who was scheduled to start working there the next following week, said she put Sokolowski to work behind the bar the first night they met, simply to get her away from Bassett. She instructed a regular at the bar and a DJ that night to ensure Sokolowski and Bassett were never alone together. I hope he doesn't beat me tonight, Ewing recalled Sokolowski saying that night, to which the defendant laughed in the courtroom. The statement struck from the record was one the jury was instructed to disregard after backroom conversations between attorneys. That was intentional, defense attorney Paul Rounds whispered to co-counsel Michelle Wolf after the witness's statement before objecting to what they said were underhanded state tactics out of the jury's presence. Sokolowski said just that she didn't want her stuff to be burned again, Ewing said seconds later in her testimony before the defense promptly interrupted the direct examination to voice more objections privately. But this time the objections turned into a motion. The court directed the state to warn the witness about this exact statement, burning property, Wolf said, moving for a mistrial declaration. Instead, what happened is the state asked the same question over and over, trying to get more information. The state was put on notice that this was an objectionable answer, but still elicited it from this. District Court Judge Amy Moore denied the motion, saying she didn't believe it was deliberate and that evidence of property destruction and physical assault were already available elsewhere in the record for the jury's consideration. Earlier in the day, the state introduced evidence of a protection order between Bassett and Sokolowski, one remnant from Bassett's domestic abuse assault conviction they were allowed to admit. Tying one loose end from state witness testimony last week, a McFarland Clinic physician's assistant who examined Sokolowski weeks before she died noted that the victim's only documented allergy was penicillin. Nurse practitioner Jeremy Waldo, the attending medical provider at Van Deese Medical Center who examined Sokolowski the night she died, said that the victim's airway was one of the most swollen cases he had seen in 20 years of practice. The only things he said could cause that would be trauma or an allergic reaction. Her neck was swollen to the point that medical providers were unable to fully intubate her during resuscitation efforts, witness told the jury. Heading back to the main page of The Messenger, the Calvary Family Center Daycare announces its sponsorship of the Child and Adult Care Food Program. Meals are prepared without regard to race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability. Child care participants who are members of FIP or food assistant households or who are Head Start participants are automatically eligible to receive free meals. Adult care participants who are members of the food assistance households or who are SSI or Medicaid participants are automatically eligible to receive free meal benefits. Meals are available at no separate charge to children, to enrolled children and adults at the center. CGI Communications Incorporated and the City of Fort Dodge have announced the continuation of community video programs. Fort Dodge has extended its agreement with CGI Communications to update the city's online videos, highlighting the opportunity to Dodge the Ordinary and everything the community has to offer its residents, visitors, and businesses. As a completely free program, the community video program strives to market Fort Dodge through updated footage and interesting commentary. In exchange for these free videos, the city is obligated to feature them on its official website, fortdodgeiowa.org. Additionally, the city will be reaching out to other partner organizations to promote the videos by including links on their websites to increase the viewer viewership. Let's try that again, to increase the video viewership. While the community videos are being produced, members of the CGI staff will reach out to business owners regarding sponsorship opportunities. In addition, the video tour on our website will backlink to CGI's www.elocallink.tv, which hosts the videos, providing increased exposure for all participants. To learn more about sponsorship opportunities or to request an appointment, you may email CGI Vice President Brandon Bartz at brandonb@cgicompany.com. We're going to head over next to the opinion page of The Messenger. Moving up to provide better service to the hungry is the Messenger editorial's title for today. The Lord's Cupboard has new accommodations. The pantry's address is still the same. It's still located at 127 North 10th Street in the First United Methodist Church office building, but it has moved up and is now located on the main floor. For the first time in its history, the Lord's Cupboard is not in a basement. This is an important move because it makes the site easily accessible to anyone who has a disability or just has trouble navigating a staircase. The stairs were hard on some of the volunteers as well as clients, and since the pantry serves about 300 households a month, there was a lot of traffic up and down those stairs. The move upstairs makes better service possible. The new accommodations include a large main pantry room, several storage closets, a waiting room, and handicap accessible bathrooms. The project was designed by Allers Associates Architects of Fort Dodge. Colossian Construction, also of Fort Dodge, was the general contractor. The move was completed just last weekend when local Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts helped get all the food upstairs. The move was made possible because the congregation of First United Methodist Church gave 2/3 of the building's main floor to the Lord's Cupboard. Renovating that space to make it usable for the food pantry cost about $250,000. Fortunately, an anonymous donor promised to match up to $100,000 in donations to the project. What resulted was a genuine improvement in service to our neighbors who need help putting food on the table. Those who donated to the project, the congregation of First United Methodist Church, the staff and volunteers of the Lord's Cupboard, the architects and the construction workers who made it happen, deserve our thanks. And that is today's Messenger editorial. Messenger editorial that appeared previously in the Messenger. This is from the Las Vegas Review Journal, entitled "Biden Abandons Pledge for Unity and Push for a Relief Bill." In his inaugural address, President Joe Biden said that unity is the path forward to overcoming our nation's challenges. He said it would restore the soul and secure the future of our country, and insisted that we have never, ever, ever failed in America when we have acted together. If the president's $1.9 trillion virus stimulus plan is any indication, however, that spirit of bipartisanship is purely optional for his side. On February 3rd, the House approved a budget resolution that would trigger a procedure known as reconciliation, which would allow Democrats to avoid a filibuster in the Senate and pass a stimulus bill with a simple majority without Republican votes in the upper chamber. The resolution came just 2 days after Mr. Biden met with Senate Republicans to discuss their concerns with the legislation. As the Washington Post reported, the 10-member GOP group led by Senator Susan Collins of Maine countered the president's plan with a narrower $618 billion proposal that would drop several elements opposed by the GOP. The Republican effort would not include an increase of the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour and would reduce the size of the next round of stimulus checks from $1,400 per individual to $1,000 while tightening the income limits that determines who receives checks. Media reports noted that Senator Collins appeared upbeat after the nearly two-hour-long meeting, but no deal was reached, though she said both sides agreed to, quote, follow up and talk further. Don't count on it. The meeting appeared to be all for show. While Mr. Biden told House Democrats last week that he's open to tweaking some elements of his plan, Politico reported that the president told those on the call that he's unwilling to bend the size of the $1,400 payment. He also remains committed to acting quickly. Let's stick together. I have your back, and I hope you'll have mine, Biden told House Democrats later that day in his first meeting with the group since being sworn in. The budget measure approved by the lower chamber on February 3rd passed in a 218 to 212 vote. It directs a dozen committees to begin drafting the various pieces of Mr. Biden's bill, including $1,400 in stimulus checks, $350 billion in bailouts for states and local governments, and a minimum wage hike that would crush many struggling businesses, although the president began to back off that plan by the weekend after the Senate had started the process of ramming the bill through without a single GOP vote. Mr. Biden's swift rejection of the Republican plan, the lack of further negotiations, and his call for Congress to act immediately indicates that the only unity he cares about is the unity on his side of the aisle. The downside for the president is that he and his fellow Democrats will own this giant vote-buying porkapalooza all by themselves. And that is an editorial from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. From the Freeman Journal, Webster City Council hears an update on the COVID loan program. Webster City Vitality Director Lindsay Henderson gave the City Council an update on the COVID-19 forgivable loan program implemented last May to help area businesses impacted by the pandemic. The city awarded 47 loans, either in the amount of $2,500 or $5,000, totaling $150,000 to help the businesses with rent, mortgages, payroll, and other related charges. Henderson said a survey was sent to businesses who received the loans to see how they are currently faring. She did not call out any individual businesses, but said overall she's seen many of the businesses continuing to report declining revenues. I don't know of any businesses that received a loan that has actually closed due to COVID, Henderson said, so that's good news. In comparing the second quarter to the same 3 months last year, there are more of them that are reporting lower revenues, as opposed to the first quarter, there were some that were about the same to the period the year before, and some that reported a bump in revenue, she said. Henderson said that the initial boost in sales may have been partially due to area residents' enthusiasm to purchase items locally. Maybe some of that has started to decline, she said, noting that the initial stimulus payment may have added in those local sales. Again, it's good that we've not lost any businesses, but we're seeing a higher percentage showing a decline in revenue and a lower status even compared to the first quarter reporting, she said. Henderson said that the city council had approved up to $250,000, but ended up loaning $150,000. She said she had not received any requests for additional support. Thankfully, we're seeing COVID numbers decline with the application of safety measures, such as wearing masks, she said. She added that fall and winter tend to be slower months for many businesses. I would encourage local people to continue to support our local businesses as much as you can, she said. Several of the businesses said this loan program has made the difference for them. And that is from the Webster City Freeman Journal. Continuing from the Freeman Journal, Fuller Hall is going to ease certain restrictions. The Fuller Hall gym is now available for families to reserve for play and exercise, according to Larry Flaws, Director of Recreation and Public Grounds. Flaws gave the City Council an update Monday night on the COVID-19 mitigation procedures in place and the changes to restrictions in the facility. We probably average 50 to 60 people per day, he said, adding that the cardio weight room and pool have been open to those 15 years and older. Floss said the gym would be open to family units, including parents or guardians and children, to shoot baskets. The space in the gym would be divided in half, with each side able to accommodate two families with a maximum of 10 per side. Each group would be required to bring in their own basketball and would have to wear a face mask. The organized teams with an adult coach would be able to use the gym for practice and would again have to provide their own basketball, volleyball, or other equipment, according to Floss. Racquetball courts are now open for those 18 and older to play racquetball. No volleyball, a team sport, would be allowed at this time. Parents of preschool children can now use the gym for indoor park from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Participants will have to bring their own toys to use, and only 10 children per side of the gym will be allowed at one time. Other areas of Fuller Hall that are open for use include the swimming pool, which is open for lap swimming and free swimming, limited to 20 swimmers at a time, the game room, limited to 10 individuals at a time, and the TV area, also open to 10 people at a time. The thing that's not allowed right now at Fuller Hall is for kids to come and just hang out, but that could change soon, he said. Floss said that once his staff has received the COVID-19 vaccine, he plans to open the facility for after-school use by children based on the following schedule. 3:30 to 5 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for students in grades 7 through 12, with a maximum of 40 allowed at any one time. On Tuesday and Thursday, students in grades 2nd through 6 will be allowed to use Fuller Hall from 3:30 to 5 o'clock with a maximum of 40 students at a time. Masks will be required, Floss said. Monday through Saturday evenings, as well as all day Saturday, will be open to all ages with a limit of 40 persons. Parties and group meetings will still not be allowed at this time. Hamilton County had just 2 new positive cases of COVID-19 in the 24 hours from Saturday to Sunday, according to data from the website iowacovid19tracker.org. That's iowacovid19tracker.org. The data shows that 5 individuals were tested for the coronavirus during the same period. 2 individuals were reported to be recovered during the same 24-hour period. Hamilton County has had a cumulative total of 1,703 positive cases out of the 6,835 individuals who have been tested. Reporting of COVID-19 statistics began in March 2020. A total of 1,553 Hamilton County residents have recovered from the coronavirus. Deaths attributed to COVID-19 total 38 for Hamilton County, with COVID-19 being attributed as the underlying cause in 37 cases and a contributing factor in 1 case, according to information on the dashboard at the state website coronavirus.iowa.org. Since Monday, February 8th, there have been 27 new cases of COVID-19 in Hamilton County, bringing the county's positivity rate to 9% for the past 7 days. In the 2 days since February 1st, there have been 55 new cases, a 12% positivity rate, according to Iowa COVID-19tracker.org. Keep on to say tractor. From February 8th through the 11th, there were 4 hospitalizations in Hamilton County throughout Region 3 of Iowa, the northwest corner of the state, which includes Hamilton County. The Regional Medical Coordination Center dashboard shows just 13 patients are hospitalized for COVID-19. That's down from 15 from the previous 24 hours. Just 2 admissions were reported in the 24 hours from February 12th and 13th, down from 6 in the previous 24 hours. 3 patients are reported to be on a ventilator in Region 3. As of Friday, February 12th, there are 3 Webster City students who have tested positive and 1 staff member, according to the COVID-19 dashboard on the Webster City Schools website. 27 students are in quarantine as of Friday. From the Marshalltown Times-Republican, documents filed in the Marshall County Court reveal some additional information on what happened in the early morning hours of Monday at Casey's on 3rd Avenue when Michael Ray West, age 48, of Marshalltown, was killed. Rocky Dean Trujillo, 20, of Marshalltown, entered a Casey's with a small caliber handgun, shot West, who was an employee of Casey's, in the chest, and attempted to get money from one of the cash registers. Afterward, the alleged killer threatened a customer by placing the barrel of the handgun against the customer's head and demanded a cell phone. Trujillo fled to the 700 block of Bromley Street, 3 blocks away from Casey's. He was arrested on Monday after Marshalltown Police Department and the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation conducted interviews of potential witnesses. While law enforcement were watching the residence Trujillo was at, He set the weapon used in the crimes with another person. When officers stopped the vehicle leaving the house, they found a handgun and a 12-gauge shotgun, which was stolen. Trujillo is being held at the Marshall County Jail, and a preliminary hearing is scheduled for February 26. A public defender has been appointed for him. He is charged with first-degree murder, first-degree robbery, going armed with intent, assault with intent to inflict serious injury, and trafficking in stolen weapons. Marshall County Sheriff's Office, Marshalltown Fire Department, and Unity Point Ambulance Service all responded to the initial 911 call for this incident. This is an active investigation. Anyone with information about this crime should call the Marshalltown Police Department at 641-754-5725. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information for the Service for the Blind. And now we will take a look at today's Messenger obituary page. Rex Donald Moore II. Rex Donald Moore II, 67, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, February 13th at the Paula J. Beaver Hospice Home after a three-year courageous battle with lung cancer. His son Heath and grandson Tanner never left his side. Visitation is set for 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock Friday, February 19th at Laufesweiler Funeral Home. Rex was born on June 24th, 1953 in Fort Dodge to parents Rex and Geraldine Stufflebean Moore. He attended Fort Dodge Senior High School and graduated in 1972. On February 10, 1973, he was united in marriage to Roxanne Biggs, and the couple established their home in Fort Dodge. The couple then moved to Otho, where they raised their children, Heather and Heath. The couple later divorced. Rex spent time working for Pepsi and Iowa Beef. On July 15, 1985, Rex started working for Fort Dodge Asphalt. He retired in November of 2017 after 32 years. Rex loved hunting, fishing, and boating. His souped-up Chevy S10 pickup, Blackie, was his prized possession. It was known for head-turning, infamous burnouts that left rubber scars on the pavement for weeks. Rex took immense pride in putting on the biggest and best fireworks display, all for the kids, that everyone was welcome to attend. He spent a great deal of time at Amigos, where he paved the way for lifelong friendships, Bo Billy Lass, and everlasting memories for so many to enjoy. He enjoyed playing Mississippi Stud and Blackjack at the casinos in Waterloo, Jefferson, and Tama. Rex is survived by his son Heath and Maley, grandson Tanner and Lexi Weiss, great-granddaughters, his girls, Audrey, Elena, and Adley, his ex-wife Roxanne and Randy, siblings Dan and Kathy and Patty and Harold, along with many nieces, nephews, and friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, daughter Heather, brother Billy Joe, and sister Sharon Wendell. The family requests in lieu of flowers or plants to drink a beer, take a shot, or have a Mountain Dew. Richard Moline from Humboldt, Corporal Richard Raymond Moline, 87, died peacefully on Wednesday, February 10th, surrounded by his family. Richard was a decorated veteran who served in the Korean War and spent another couple of years in service. Richard was preceded in death by his parents and his sister Eileen Guderian and her husband Harold Guderian. He survived by his wife Donna Powers Moline, his sister Patricia and Bob Swanson, his daughters Christina and Bernie Roche, Jewel Lee Grant, Susan Moline, and Richard Rice, and Kelly Cross, Stephen Boster, as well as grandchildren Dale Oliver, Tovia Barber, Bree Anna Barber, Sean Richard and Sophia O'Brien, Aaron John O'Brien, Taylor Patrick Payne, Troy Mitchell Allen Cross, and step-grandchildren Marcus and Chelsea Cross, Preston Cross, Joshua Boster, and Jackson Boster. The family requests that in lieu of flowers, please make a donation to the Shining Mountain Lutheran Church in Bozeman, Montana. Richard served this church with dedication and passion. Mason Linhart Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Humboldt, Patrilla A. Johnson. Patrilla Ann Ridgely Johnson, 91, of Humboldt, died peacefully, surrounded by family, on Tuesday, February 9th, at the Humboldt Care Center South. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, son Stephen, son-in-law Jean Fedkenhuer, sister and brother-in-law Leah and Robert Orslod, and grandsons Charles and Robert Lee. Patrilla is survived by a daughter, Nita Fedkenhuer, son Ronald and Marlene Johnson, 7 grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, and many great-great-grandchildren. Her sisters-in-law, Arlene Sweeney, and Dorothy Johnson, and many nieces and nephews. Family services will be held at Mason Linhart Funeral Home Saturday, February 20th, with burial at a later date in North Lawn Cemetery, Fort Dodge. Mason Linhart Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Eugene V. Baker. Eugene V. Baker, 91, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, February 13th at Friendship Haven. Funeral services will be Saturday, February 20th at 11 o'clock at Holy Trinity Church, with Monsignor Kevin McCoy officiating the Mass of Christian Burial. Burial will follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery with military rites conducted by VFW Post 1856 in the United States Navy Honor Guard. Visitation is Saturday from 10 to 11 at the church. The service will be live-streamed by Loffesweiler Funeral Home on their Facebook page. From Albert City, Danny McFarland. Funeral services for Danny McFarland will be 2 p.m. Wednesday at the Slifert Funeral Home in Albert City. Visitation is 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. Slifert Funeral Home in Albert City is in charge of arrangements. Roger Fiala. Roger Joseph Fiala, 82, of Tehachapi, California, and formerly in Moreland, died on January 31st, 2021, in California, after a well-fought battle with cancer. Services will be held February 27th at 2:30 at Bruce Funeral Home in Fort Dodge. Graveside service at the Elkhorn Township Cemetery in rural Moreland. Services will be live-streamed at the Bruce Funeral Home Facebook page. The celebration of life ceremony will be held March 20th at 11 o'clock Pacific Time at Grace Chapel in Lancaster, California. The event will be live-streamed on YouTube. For link, please email Brendan Smethurst at denorbrenda@gmail.com. That's Dean or Brenda at gmail.com. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in Roger's name to the Widows and Orphans and Disabled Firefighters Fund, Post Office Box 41903, Los Angeles, California, 90041. And that completes today's obituary page. We'll turn over to the sports section. Instant Impact is the title of a column that appears in today's Messenger. Usually an athlete's first season of college is a feeling out process that typically ends in a redshirt year. Fort Dodge senior high graduate Carson Taylor has taken a different path, blazing a trail in his first season, competing for top-ranked Grandview University in Des Moines. On Saturday, the former Dodger state champion and two-time finalist etched his name into the Vikings' record book, becoming the first true freshman in school history to win a Heart of America Athletic Conference / regional title at 133 pounds. Winning the conference as a freshman is an awesome feeling, especially to be the first to do it at Grandview, Taylor said. I've made jumps this year just by being able to compete a ton. Having those experiences definitely shows me what I need to work on during practice. With the victory, Taylor has earned a spot in the national tournament being held March 5th and 6th in Wichita, Kansas. I'm still learning and ready to show what I can do at the national tournament, Taylor said. Grandview State claimed to their sixth straight league crown, 216.5 points. Missouri Valley followed up with 146.5 points in second place. Taylor, who had 121 career wins as a Dodger, recorded 3 falls on the way to the championship. In the quarterfinals, the third-ranked Viking pinned Brett Parson of Central Methodist in a minute 17. Taylor then put Dickinson State's Clay Gerhardt shoulders to the mat in 4:43. The former Dodger pinned 11th-ranked Dominique Arellano of Baker, Kansas in 2:57 for gold. All 12 Grandview wrestlers reached the finals with 8 earning conference gold, including clearing Bloomfield Dallas graduate Justin Portillo, who is ranked first at 125 pounds. Tanner Abbas at 157, also a CGD graduate, lost to top-ranked teammate Giovanni Bonilla in the finals. Abbas is rated second nationally. Mixed emotions for Hartley as the Iowa swimming program lives on is the title of the next article. On the surface, Monday's official reinstatement of the University of Iowa women's swimming and diving program seemed like a feel-good end to a story filled with turmoil and uncertainty. In reality, the scars are deep and the fight seems far from over. Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta confirmed the news in a face-to-face meeting with a group of Hawkeye student athletes yesterday afternoon, some 6 months after the school had first announced deep financial cuts were necessary due to COVID-19 global pandemic. Initially, both Iowa men's and women's swimming and diving, men's tennis, and men's gymnastics programs were to be eliminated as per an official meeting on August 21st, 2020. The women's program is back on solid ground. What that means beyond an initial sigh of relief, according to former Fort Dodge Senior High All-Stater and current Hawkeye Junior team member Taylor Hartley, remains to be seen. We knew that the team was going to be reinstated for at least one season as part of a court-ordered injunction, which we found out in December, Hartley said. Many of us started to grow frustrated with the administration as they provided little to no information about what this meant up until Monday. That's when we were told the women's team only would be having a meeting during practice and BARDA would be there. At 2:15, Gary walked in and told us that the women's program would be reinstated indefinitely. I wouldn't necessarily describe the feeling in the room as excited, because for some of my teammates, this news still won't change the fact that they are transferring at the end of the year. There has just been so much uncertainty, it's hard to really find closure in this news, especially because only half of our team is coming back since the men are not being reinstated. According to a press release from the university, the athletic department estimated a financial deficit of $75 million as a result of the ongoing COVID pandemic. A plan was developed to help mitigate the shortfall, which included operational budget cuts, salary reductions, position eliminations, and discontinuance of the aforementioned four sports at the conclusion of the 2021 season. The estimated deficit has been reduced to approximately $50 to $60 million due to those mitigation efforts and limited revenues generated during the modified football season, but the financial challenge remains significant and the decision to discontinue the three men's sports identified will remain in place, the official statement announced. In September, a lawsuit was filed challenging the decision to discontinue women's swimming specifically. The preliminary injunction was to continue to offer the sport next year as the lawsuit made its way through the court system. However, in the interest of serving our student-athletes, coaches, and community, the university believes more certainty will be beneficial for the future of the program, the statement continued. Accordingly, the university has decided it is in the best interest of the student-athletes, coaches, and athletics department to voluntarily reinstate the program regardless of any outcome related to the lawsuit. BARDA called it the right thing to do. Every student athlete in all 24 sports at Iowa has experienced challenges and uncertainty since the pandemic began. This has been especially true for the men and women in the four sports we announced would be discontinued after this season, BARDA said. The women's swimming lawsuit brought forward last September, combined with the recent court order mandating the continuation of the sport during the legal process, has created additional uncertainty that could last several months or even years. Hartley said the meeting was contentious and the conclusion felt like a relatively hollow victory. After telling us we were reinstated, we were allowed to ask BARDA any questions we might have. People did not hold back their frustrations with him and with the decision to cut the team in the first place. The answers we got were the same financial reasons we were given in August, which was frustrating as well. I am so happy the team is coming back and there will be still opportunities for young women to swim at Iowa, and that I will get the chance to finish my career here as a senior next season. But at the same time, it's very bittersweet. Many of my teammates are still leaving, and the men's swimming team, as well as the men's tennis and gymnastic teams, aren't getting the same opportunity. Hartley is an academic All-Big Ten selection and Dean's List honoree, majoring in health and human physiology. She is the daughter of Fort Dodge's Bruce and Tracy Hartley. Former Dodger Andrew Fierk is a member of the Hawkeye men's team. Like Hartley, Fierk is also a Hawkeye junior. Iowa is back in action at the Big Ten Championships February 23rd through the 25th in Minneapolis. A slow start proved costly for the St. Edmund boys Monday night in Britt as they were knocked out of the postseason with a 45-35 loss to the homestanding West Hancock. The Eagles, 12-11 on the season, used a 15-0 run through the latter stages of the second quarter and into the third to secure the win in the Class 1A Substate 2 contest on their home floor. They advanced to Thursday night to meet Lake Mills, the 75-28 winner over West Bend Mallard. Playing in his final game as a Gale, Anthony Lacina scored 11 points in the fourth quarter to provide one final spark. Jackson Palmer and Hayden Mayer added 8 each. "We just weren't getting our shots," said St. Anne's coach Adolf Kochendorfer. "We were getting decent looks. They just weren't falling. We turned the ball over too much." West Hancock relied heavily on the brother duo of Ryland and Kaysen Barnes. Ryland knocked down 3 3-pointers and scored a game-high 19, with Kaysen adding 14. Ryland also had 8 rebounds and 6 steals, with Kaysen recording a double-double behind his 10 rebounds. The Eagles worked their 2-3 zone to perfection, forcing 9 St. Edmund turnovers in the first quarter while scoring the first 9 points of the game. The Gales did cut the deficit to 6 as Mayer and Quentin McCarville combined for all 7 points in the opening 8 minutes. We really worked on going against that zone in practice, but it's really hard to duplicate it," Kochendorfer said. "We wanted to be aggressive, but we were just in too much of a hurry at times." In the second, West Hancock remained patient on offense, working the ball to find the open shooter. Ryland Barnes scored 7, and Kaysen Barnes added 4 as they closed the half with an 8-0 run to take a 24-11 lead. That advantage would balloon to go behind 8 straight points to start the third, with the 4 of the 5 starters getting into the scoring column. Cole Chiso added 6 points, 4 rebounds, and 3 steals for the Eagles, who recorded 13 teams as a steal and forced 23 turnovers. Carville finished with 6 points and 7 rebounds, while Drew Schaefer added a bucket. Lucina had 6 rebounds and 2 steals. "I feel like we wore down a little late in the season," Kochendorfer said. "We were playing the bigger schools almost every night, and we just didn't have the bodies to take that physically. It really played a role in how we performed the last 6 or 7 games. It's tough when you're playing hard but not coming away with wins." The game marked the final time in a St. Edmund basketball uniform for Lucina, Schaefer, Sean Flattery, Grant Heldorfer, and this group shared the court as the buzzer sounded. "This was a good group, a bunch of seniors, and I'm very proud of them," Kochendorfer said. "We will miss them. Anthony had a real solid game. Drew has been fun to watch these last 4 years, and Sean is a really hard worker. Grant was like having a coach on the bench and in practice, and Andrew always played hard." St. Edmund girls are back in action. St. Edmund girls get their chance at pulling an upset when they take on 2-time defending Class 1A state champion Newell Fonda in a Region 2 quarterfinal in Newell Tuesday night. Tip is set for 7 o'clock, with the winner advancing to face either Audubon or Glidden Ralston in the semifinals on Friday in Newell. The Gales are 4-16 for the season and advanced with a commanding 58-22 victory over Ankeny Christian last week in the postseason opener. Leah Nemmerman had 14 points, 10 rebounds, 4 steals, and 4 blocks, while Maya McKean added 10 points and 5 steals. Casey Krutoff chipped in 8 points, Kelly Kirsten had 5 rebounds, and Leah Johnson had 3 assists. On the year, Nemmerman averages 10.5 points over 8 rebounds, with McKean, Krutoff, Kirsten Clark, and Gracie Harvey all adding over 4 points a night. The 4 wins under first-year head coach C.J. Tracy matches the most for St. Edmund since the 2017-18 season. Newell Fonda is 20-1 for the year and is ranked 2nd behind Bishop Garrigan, who handed the Mustangs their lone loss this year. Newell Fonda bested the Golden Bears for the state title last winter. Bailey Severs, Macy Severs, and Maggie Walker all average over 12 points per game to lead the Mustangs. Newell Fonda leads the state at 80.2 points per game, 21.2 assists per game, 21.7 steals per game under the direction of legendary head coach Dick Youngers. They are also first in made field goals and field goal attempts, 31.8 for 68.6. The Mustangs have won all 5 meetings between the schools. After flirting with a breakthrough victory for weeks, former Fort Dodge state champion Tristan Lara stuck the landing on Sunday by sticking Iowa State first-team All-American Jarrett Dagan. Lara's pin of Dagan in 5 minutes 30 seconds at 149 pounds highlighted what was otherwise a tempestuous day for the University of Northern Iowa wrestling team to close out the regular season. 16th-ranked Panthers are 4-4 for the season and lost to number 13 Arizona State 24-10 and the 9th-rated Cyclones 23-17. "It definitely feels good to end the season with a win like this," Lara said, a 2-time gold medalist at the Dodgers and a 2017 Ford Dodge graduate. I know I have a killer mentality inside of me. It's just a matter of showing it out on the mat. For now, I'm going to keep working, believing, and trusting in what I am doing, what I'm capable of. Now it's time to let it fly in the postseason. Lara, who is 4-4 on the year as a redshirt junior, carried a 4-3 lead into the final period, then completely took control to hand Dagan 3-1 for the year's first loss of 2021. Dagan, a redshirt senior at Iowa State with a career record of 93-34, went 16-4 and placed third in the Big 12 championships last season to qualify for the NCAA tournament. He is currently ranked 5th nationally at 149 pounds. All four of Lara's losses have come via decision, including by three points or less. Earlier this season, he was clipped by current number 3 Brock Miller of Missouri and number 17 Mitch Moore of Oklahoma. The Panthers are off until March 6th and 7th when they compete at the Big 12 Championships in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We'll take a quick look at this date in history. On this date, February 16th, archaeologists in 1923 opened the tomb of King Tut. In 1804, the United States Navy staged a daring mission during the First Barbary War. In 1878, silver dollars were made legal. In 1778, during the American Revolution, John Adams prepared to sail for France. In 1951, Joseph Stalin attacked the United Nations. In 1894, gunslinger John Wesley Hardin was pardoned. In 1968, the first 911 call was placed in the United States. In 1959, Fidel Castro was sworn in as Prime Minister. In 1984, Bill Johnson becomes first American to win the Olympic gold in downhill skiing. And in 1968, the Tet Offensive resulted in many new refugees. And that's just a handful of historical events that took place on this date, February 16th. Taking a look next at the weather forecast as our time together draws to a close. Looking at the 10-day forecast, it looks very promising, my friends. Looking for still cold on Wednesday, but a high of 9, which is welcome relief compared to where we've been. Look out, 13 degrees on a Thursday, 17 on Friday, 23 on Saturday, under mostly or partly sunny skies. Cloudy Sunday, high of 31. Partly sunny, mostly sunny, we'll call it, on Monday and Tuesday, with high 36 on Monday, high of 38 on Tuesday. Wednesday, clouds roll in, high of 33, and 33 again on Thursday. For the most part, lows at night will be in the single digits, and then when things start to warm up, we're going to see lows in the upper teens to the lower to mid 20s. So hopefully we'll get a little melting done this coming weekend. That's going to do it for this reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Of course, this podcast and many others are available to you at the iowaradioreading.org website, and we certainly encourage you to enjoy as many podcasts as possible. We thank you for your continued support of listening to IRIS. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you very much for spending this day with me, this hour with me. And we'll remind you to stay safe, stay healthy, stay warm, but hang in there. Warmer temperatures are on the way. We'll talk to you again real soon here on IRIS, Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Bye-bye for now. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.